say, kids, what time is it?
The future is coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on.
Hi, folks. Welcome to our first Best Of mix, drawn from our 15 years of being on the air. There's a strong element of serendipity in our selection of what you're about to hear, which we think you'll appreciate.
Where the now is getting recorded for the future.
For a future now time moment.
Our favorite kind, the ones we like to remember.
Ben Fuchs.
What I finally figured out is there are no secrets in the universe.
Right.
Everything is knowable.
You just have to be ready to be able to understand it, right?
It's only an issue of time. You know what it's called? It's called the obvious secret. They call it the obvious secret or something. I forgot what the term is for it, but it is like a secret, but it's right in your face kind of secret.
Always, that's the best place to hide it.
It's the best place to hide it, of course. This is the best place to hide it. Right. Without saying.
Well,
but
yeah.
It's the open secret.
Yeah.
The open secret. I like those kinds of secrets. Nothing to be afraid of. I guess that's kind of what all that psi research is all about, is trying to tap into those open secrets.
Well, I say the universe is right before you. There's thousands of principles and ideas floating before your eyes right now, just in what appears to be everydayness.
Oh, for those with eyes to see and ears to hear?
Yeah, and the mystery of the universe is there for you to explore. You don't have to go anywhere except wherever you are right now.
Uh-huh.
Just look around you.
Oh, so
it's all in your attitude.
Armchair travelers in the future of time.
Mystery caller.
The life force could be considered something that reorganizes matter into an organized structure which has influence over the environment, and it could be considered to be something that helps to form the universe in a positive way.
Penny Kelly.
So is there some point where we'll refine our consciousness enough that our species will stop being at war?
That is the test that we're at right now. We have to... As we move into the fourth dimension, nothing changes outwardly, or very little, except war goes away. And we have all new, I'm going to say, ethical bases for why we do what we do. And I put on my website a paper. When I started, it's like people talking about, oh, we're heading into 5D. And I'm like, what? What's that? What do you know about 5D? You know, you can't even get a decent prayer out, let alone shift your consciousness. So, you know, I started this research, and that really taught me a lot. So I put out this paper, it's a table, and says this is how people are on this topic or with this subject in 3D, which is where we are. Mm-hmm. This is how they think and do in 4D. This is how they think and do in 5D. And what you see, when I finally put it all on paper, it was like, oh, I see that it's a change of heart, it's a change of thinking, it's a change in choices. It's very, very powerful. At first, I thought it was subtle, but the more that I have researched that, the more I've thought, no, that's not very subtle at all. War is pretty blatant. It's pretty rough. It's pretty mean.
Yeah.
And when you get into fourth dimensional thinking, when you have raised or expanded your consciousness, you're not interested in war. Mm. That's not something that you want to engage in. That isn't something that you will support. And there have been, actually, there's a number of places on the planet, physical locations, where you can walk through an energy barrier into another zone, we'll call it.
Mm-hmm.
And the people in 3D doing war can't see you and you can't see them.
Oh, mm-hmm. They're separated.
Yeah.
And there's one theory where that if you process all the things that cause war in your own psyche, even the very subtle things that you might have with individuals even, if you can raise those, then that changes the gestalt of everyone.
It does. It does. That's one of the things we were just working on in one of my classes. I said to people, if you have an argument with somebody, let's say you and your husband have a big argument.
Yeah.
And it's the same argument every time. Usually you argue about the same thing. And there'll be a trigger word. And spouses know just how to push one another's buttons.
They do.
They do.
Yes, they do.
You end up, as you begin to expand your consciousness and move away from war, you end up realizing, oh, here we go again. So that then would lead a fourth dimensional person to say, okay, that topic really irritates the bejabbers out of me. I need to do something. So the next time that comes up, you're aware that you're walking right into it, but you've kind of got your eyes open. You can't catch it in time. You still end up in the argument, but you're watching and you know where the turning point is, where you lose all communication. It's like, piss on you, go to hell. Well, you know, that
catch that before the chemicals kick in.
Right. You know? Exactly. Yeah. So the second time then you say, okay, I see where the turning point was. If that comes up again, I'm going to be watching and I'm going to turn that around. Mm. And so the second time you catch the trigger words. And then the third time you come to that same point and you realize, there it is, I know that's it, but you can't quite get ahead of it quite enough. But the fourth time, that argument is over.
Fourth time's the charm.
The fourth time is a charm, yep. And the result, what happens is, after that third time, you have, most people blank out. They don't remember the argument, all they remember is the feeling. They don't remember the specific words. In the third time of really watching that argument, they are listening to the back and forth, and they're realizing, what could I say different? What tone? How could I produce a different tone, even if I use the same words or whatever? Mm-hmm. And you're in your own head after the argument's over, and you're not speaking, so you have plenty of time to process this. But you're asking yourself, okay, what if I had said this? And you play that out in your mind. Okay. Well, what if I had said that? And you play that out in your mind. And you keep doing that. Sometimes you'll play out 8 or 9 scenarios, and then, boom, all of a sudden, there'll be this. You'll say, what if I said this? And there's this feeling of goosebumps all the way through you, and you realize, that's what I need to say. When you have that realization, so does the person you had the argument with. So they're ready the next time you come to that place. And the whole thing, it's like, okay, I'm just going to listen, or I'm just going to feel my way through, or whatever it is that you knew you had to say that would let the other know that you're hearing, you're listening, you're caring.
That you're ready to let that go and move on.
Yeah.
So somehow the energy shifts and then the relationship
And when you
follows.
Shifted in that imaginary scenario that you're playing out, all these different, what about this, what about that? You're looking for the right shoes that will fit just right. And as soon as you put those on, you know it all the way through you, and that gets communicated to the other. That same thing happens around war. If we could listen to whoever, you know, we're fighting with, whatever the wartime, the people that are managing the whole thing right now is, those people are a disaster.
Well,
oh my God.
It seems like we should have more power with rather than power over.
Exactly.
Well, the thing is, the we has really splintered. I think the problem is that most people in the world that we walk in, the three of us and the people that we talk to and are connected to us, we're not the people that are putting these energies out there and in motion. We are the people who are listening while they cultivate their rationale.
Yeah, that's true. But you don't realize until you understand how consciousness works that those people are holding the space, and while others are joining that consciousness. And there's a tipping point.
I actually do realize that.
Yeah, very good.
The reason I'm mentioning it is because I was wondering, at the level of the kind of transformation you're talking about between a married couple, is how do we participate in the realization of the energy with those people that only think of us as people that need to be broadcasted to? How do we actually engage energetically in the conversation that helps them stop pushing it in the way that they are? Since we know that there's a wound and they're living the wound, or there's a desire, or there's something in the personalities that are making it happen from their deep creative force. And how do we shift it so that they're putting that energy into something that is actually beneficial?
I think the techniques that I have learned, some of them have been really helpful. If you take a stance, first of all, you have to get really, really quiet inside yourself. absolutely still, and you're listening, and then you begin questioning. Instead of trying to put your point of view out, you're asking the other to share the whole spectrum, all the aspects of what they're dealing with. And while you're listening, they're listening. And you are silent strategically, so that what they just said hangs in the air for a moment and they hear themselves. That has a profoundly positive effect on somebody's ability to stop arguing, stop pushing violence or racism or all the stupid stuff that people are pushing out there. It's like, okay.
So emotions want to be heard.
Yeah, where are you going with that? You know, I don't even try to tell people anything. I just ask questions and listen. And then, you know, I'll say, well, what if this? Well, what if that? And they work their way through the whole scenario and end up right where they need to be. And the argument is over. So we do not have good people in charge right now. So people like you guys and a lot of my students and others, there's a bunch of people out there. Mm. There's a lot of people out there. They're holding this space for the time, and it is a timing thing, for the time to come when we have to turn it around, turn it over.
Yes.
And we're very close to that.
Yeah, timing. Though, do you and your circle of friends have anyone that really want to get into politics?
Or are you kidding?
Or run corporations?
No.
See, so what does that tell you?
Yeah.
Does that mean that maybe
that
those,
time is over?
Yeah, yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe there's new structures that are forming that more have affinity with.
The structure that politics represents is the aggregate will. That's the space that's held by religion. It's the space that's held by peaceful families. It's the space that's held by people who see themselves as extensions of something larger than themselves.
Oh, yeah.
But it's actually very different than this, what I feel is the wave of conscious awareness that is sweeping us now, which is self-awareness and the idea of becoming the source that is connected to the larger source, as opposed to letting the outside tell you what to do. So
yeah. And I divvy that up a little bit from my point of view. Governance is, how do I want to discipline myself? That's the external symbol of government. Food is, what do I want to feed myself? Education is, what can I learn inside myself? You can't really learn. Well, you can go to school and you can borrow ideas from other people, but true learning is what you come to recognize within yourself. That's the only real knowledge there is. The rest of it is book stuff. And I write books, so I don't want to criticize books too much.
Yeah. Well, yes, but, it's like books as the foundation of your knowledge is a mistake. We should really go more directly to...
Right, right. So, you know, there's a whole bunch of religion. That's the symbol of the structure of belief within us. It has been corrupted. It has been distorted. The personal, what the robes call the inner authority, that's been gone for a long time. And they said, you need to get that back if you're going to survive. You need to connect to Mother Nature if you're going to survive. And for a long time, I thought, okay, I'm not sure how those two things fit together. But I'm beginning to realize now that they're not talking about growing carrots and tomatoes and that kind of thing, or doing some kind of climate change project. They're talking about the true nature of the human, which is the capacity to know anything that you want to know, and to allow yourself to feel that first and then let that feeling take shape as a vision if you're primarily visual, or as a message if you're primarily auditory, or as a taste if you're primarily, you learn, and babies do, they put everything in their mouth. So that's a primary learning channel, is tasting.
Mm. So in your understanding of real education, you're self-referencing what you really know, rather than what you think is real from the books you've read.
Yeah.
So that includes science and understanding atoms and
that's
quarks.
True.
Nick Herbert.
There's a place called Seabright Beach.
Seabright Beach.
It's right close to the Yacht Harbor.
Yes.
And some time ago, I was attending a gathering there hosted by some women who called themselves the Holy Hemp Sisters. You may remember some of them. Some of them are still around.
Holy Hemp Sisters?
The Holy Hemp Sisters.
Is there more than two of them?
Oh, yeah, there are numbers of them. There might have been at least a dozen.
Really?
And they would wear necklaces of artificial hemp, of course, because regular hemp at that time wasn't really legal.
Not as liberal as it is today.
Not as liberal. But these were plastic hemp flowers that they wore. And so they gathered to light a bonfire and share food and drumming and singing and dancing and partake of sacraments there. Mm. And I got there a little early, and the event hadn't quite started yet. Mm. So I decided I would take off my shoes and socks and go wade in the Pacific Ocean, since it was right there.
Exactly. So did you?
I did so. I walked down to the tide line. The tide was coming in, and I walked along in my bare feet along the tide line, and I could see in the distance there was a tall woman with a long skirt.
That heading, you were approaching?
She was doing the same thing, walking barefoot in the surf and approaching me. And getting closer and closer, and she was about 15 or 20 feet away, and a big wave came by, a little bigger than usual, and she grabbed her skirts and pulled them up so that her skirt wouldn't get wet. And she showed off this marvelous pair of long legs right there on the edge of the ocean. It reminded me of those 50s pinup girls that we used to call cheesecake, showing these big long legs.
Yeah, Marilyn Monroe with her wind blowing her dress up comes to mind.
It was exactly that format. Of what it would be very tame today, but in those days that was pretty exciting to see a woman's bare legs, and it was exciting to me. I thought, this is nice. This is a nice message from the universe. And so we passed and acknowledged ourselves, and I walked further along the beach. Mm. And now I was at a place where there were no people. The beach was completely abandoned, and then right at the tide line, I saw a message written in block letters. Someone had written a long time ago, probably because there was no one there now, and the tide was coming in. Mm. And the message said, "Will you marry me?"
In the sand?
In the sand. It was scratched into the sand. "Will you marry me?" And then the tide came in, the waves came in, and washed it away.
Oh, boy.
Had I
guess
been there.
That's a limited time offer.
That's a limited time offer, exactly. Exactly, son. A limited time offer. And so that inspired this poem to the Pacific Ocean, okay. Song to the Pacific Ocean, which I will now impose on you.
Yeah, here it is. Song to the Pacific.
It's called "The Man Who Married the Sea." "Will you marry me?" said the sea. "Will you take my name?" "Yes, I will," I answered back, and to the sea I came. "Will you marry me?" said the sea. "Would you be my fiancée?" "I've spread myself beneath the moon in kelp and coral lingerie." "Will you marry my estuary? Will you copulate with my slough? Do you take my foamy white breakers?" "I will," said I, "and I do." "But would you dare to wed the sea? We practice deep polygamy. So he, she, it would marry thee, and no one ever leaves the sea."
Oh, no.
"Will you marry me?" said the sea. "Would you share my deep, salty life? Would you be the sea's newest husband? Would you be the ocean's next wife?" "Will you marry me?" said the sea. "Would you offer me your heart?" "Why get married?" my heart replied. "I belong to the sea from the start."
Saved by the right answer.
Carolyn Casey.
What comes to us as blessed are the meek, you know, used by the Dementors to justify inequality, he said in Aramaic it's more like, "Blessed are those who soften emotional rigidity within their hearts, for they shall have all the power of nature." You go, oh, you can work with that.
Yeah, the power of love, connection with nature. Yeah, that's pretty universal.
Right. And then also he pointed out that when Jesus says, "Be as wise as serpents and as gentle as doves," the word he uses in Aramaic for serpent is the same word for Eve and wisdom. So I go, Eve, wisdom, snake, same word. So all, you know, religious wars and subjugation of women in the earth is basically a translation error, you know, and he goes, yeah, pretty much. an intentional translation error. So,
yes.
And, you know, in early Christianity, the word heretic was an honorific, like, boy, that Alan, boy, the boy, Dr. Future sure is a heretic. It meant free-thinking person, and it was admired until the religious impulse was kidnapped and hoodwinked into servitude to the state.
Well, that's when they put in the toll roads to the to the divine, right?
the privileged roads and all of that.
Yeah. Yeah, the hierarchy. Well, how much of that is from our monkey bodies? You know, I mean, there's a certain amount of code that we just inherited that is hierarchical and that is.
We wonder, well, you know, right this moment, just for the fun of it, where we both are, you know, on the West Coast, Jupiter representing the intelligence of storytelling is right rising in the east right now for all of us. And we go, ooh, so how we tell the story, and the more we know, the better. We are just as linked to bonobos, for instance, by DNA as we are to chimps.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And they resolve everything with sex and sharing.
Uh-huh.
But also...
Very good point.
Scientists did an experiment with hierarchical monkeys, dominator monkeys, bull primate, you know, and they kept adding more bull primate males, you know, and at a certain saturation point, and you can feel the analogy, what happened was half of the male monkeys were like, hey, we're out of this jockeying for position. We're going to go, we're going Jamaican. We're going to go hang out with the women and have culture. And the male... bull primates.
Can we continue this after a break? We have to go to a hard break.
Okay,
hold on a sec. We'll be right back and after the break with the conclusion of this story on primates. Thanks for holding the thought. Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking with Carolyn Casey. She was just sharing with us a story of our deep ancestors, a monkey story. Can you backtrack a little bit for the audience? More towards the beginning, we'll tell that story again, Carolyn.
You know, isn't it just in order to be grumpy and warlike and dominator, isn't it in our DNA? And we go, no, that's one story. So Science, New York Times, from which I get most of my metaphysics, let all natural facts be social strategy metaphors. Mm-hmm. So scientists took very bull primate hierarchy male monkeys and kept adding more into their thing. So they were, and you know, at a certain point, half the male monkeys were like, we're out of this game. We're going to be Jamaican. We're going to go hang out with the women, have culture. The remaining male monkeys who all strove for dominance, they all died. Either they killed each other or they died of heart disease and cancer.
Oh, geez.
So it says dominance is an evolutionary dead end. We must die to it, lest we die from it. And part of the model right now is that. I mean, right now, dominance and empire are going down, but taking so much life with it. But what's coming up, and we're all invited to be a part of this, is a renaissance of reverent ingenuity, bringing out the best of everybody, the ornery, disobedient, creative, ingenious part. But there was another science thing also, too, that took male rats and voles and whatever and said, if we expose the male rats and even the little virgin boy rats to pups, it changes their brain physiologically, in which they become like nurturing guides, you know, and even midwives, the rats and the voles and everybody, all the males would then help the mothers give birth, even lick the little baby as it's coming out. And we go, you know, let's do that. The plasticity of our brain to transcend dominance is available.
It's pretty there, yeah.
Nancy Griffith.
Yeah, how do you choose to see yourself? Are you a victim? Are you powerless? Or are you originating everything that's coming alive around you? Are you the source of your experience?
Well, that is good to think about, because victim is a concept that's been very embedded in our society as almost normal. You get money if you're a victim in a number of places.
So you can even become president of the United States if you're a victim.
Yeah.
But they vote for you,
yeah,
because they're all feeling like victims, and then you're saying you're the victim, and then.
But in the writer's world, have you heard of the victim, rescuer, persecutor triad?
Victim, rescuer, persecutor
triad.
Yes. Right, you said three things. Try again.
Victim, rescue, victim,
rescuer, persecutor, triad.
I have not heard of that, but it sounds like something that happens. It's a,
yeah, exactly. And it's the idea is that there's an energetic victims, once they're rescued, can very often bite the hand that feeds them. You might have heard of that expression.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of part of this triadic. And why does that happen?
Well, you know, and part of this triad is really related to understanding ego and shadow. Mm. It's very helpful in shadow work because when you're acting one of these three roles, you're engaging in a relationship with one of the other parts of this triad, and the third part would be in your shadow. And so you're not aware that
big on shadow. And Jung is big on shadow. He introduced the whole shadow idea, the whole concept that we have a shadow self. As exalted and wonderful as we may be, we're also horrible, terrible people. You know, we do bad things. And to embrace that is really, again, the path, not the out is through. So embrace that and accept your shadow is what he thinks is what he, Jung, meant.
Right.
By shadow, your dark side.
Don't deny your shadow.
Yeah, exactly. I'd say that's very related to what we're talking about. Because it is the understanding of the presence of this triad of the victim, the rescuer, the persecutor is very helpful in trying to recognize the path out of it so that you can become self-directing instead of a victim of circumstance.
Oh. So it's kind of a state of people get in that triad and experience life like that. Is what the triad is. So first there's a victim, and then they turn into a persecutor, and then they get rescued or rescued.
Well, there's a victim, and the rescuer rescues the victim. The victim turns out to be not that grateful to the rescuer in the long run and blames them because they get into a bad situation again.
The rescuer, in a condition where, say, like a great military leader is presenting himself as the rescuer and then becomes the great persecutor because all that power gets concentrated.
People aren't appreciating him enough.
Yeah. And just not recognizing that it's all the same ego structure manifesting in different paradigms.
Oh, God, we see that everywhere. Hope I don't offend anybody by pointing to Israel.
You mean with the,
what incredible
with the Palestinians and the
people in Israel are the inheritors of the horrible Holocaust, many of them. I know others came from, but they suffered horribly in the Holocaust. And then they're in a situation where they're no longer suffering, but others are suffering because of them. Is that it?
Yeah, well, I see what you're saying. And I brought
this
up.
And the Palestinians,
Like the parallels of being persecuted by the Nazis is now where the Jews are persecuting the Palestinians.
And that's what I'm pointing at. And that it's a very sensitive topic, but
because,
that's what I see.
Because it hasn't been, the shadow hasn't been processed.
There you go.
In that. And I've talked to many of my Jewish friends about that. It's a big topic.
A lot of
disagreement about that.
I've never talked to anybody about that. So
it's very contentious on both sides of that.
I think so.
Because in a certain sense, it's been going on so long and so many generations that the pain is inherited rather than individual and personal. And so there's almost no escape from it.
Yeah, I've seen it. I've seen it in my own family.
Perpetuated over and over again by new people who take on the pain of others and then re-engage.
Right. Yeah. It's an identity almost, suffering and being a victim. As real as it may have been, it becomes an identity almost.
Which brings us to the frontier of where we're at right now, of the new consciousness, the new paradigm of consciousness that you are writing about, that your new paradigm literary
services
are related to.
Yes.
So maybe let's connect the dots here. Where do we go from this inherited worldview of suffering into a new consciousness? Mm-hmm. What is the path?
One of the main ways is read good books. That was my path. Books made such a big difference to me in my life. Books. I'm a word person, so it came to me through the word and also through experiential, of course. But I was first introduced to a new way of thinking through various teachings that were written in books. Krishnamurti comes to mind.
I'm a child
of Ram Dass, and just incredible. Right, remember the channeling of the channel books, the big channel.
Jane Robert, Seth Material. Seth Material.
Seth Material.
Yes,
there those books were amazing.
Yeah, The Education of Oversoul 7.
There you go. So lots of books hit me, and that's maybe why I've chosen to give back and help books get written that can help other people.
Mystery caller.
There's only one electrical field. The field is a universal field, but you have different fluctuations in it, or phenoms, or singularities, or different things are occurring, but it's all one field because it's all influenced by each other. It's like gravity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So
okay.
It's all connected, literally.
Right.
And so, but the thing is that there are phenoms happening, due to, whatever's going on. Like the sun, has, a large thing that it does to what they call the electromagnetic field. That's how scientists tend to refer to it. The field is being influenced by, the interactions of what's going on in the sun, the huge amount of activity.
Colonel Terry.
Hello, Colonel Terry. Welcome to the show.
Katie, how are you? Beautiful. You prove that a woman can be both beautiful and smart. I've been fascinated for a decade or two about the reality of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Is fundamentally what your program started out talking about, I think.
Absolutely. No, that's, I'd say, one of our main fascinations. What is conscious? What is not conscious? And what's the best kind of consciousness we all can experience?
And there are some wonderful studies done at places like Harvard and MIT and the University of Washington and elsewhere, trying to determine where the thresholds are of observation, perception, and then consciousness.
Hmm.
Again, where is that reality? And then jumping forward, I'm going to copyright my expressions, but license them to you guys to use.
Oh, thank you. So something about a consciousness?
SCO on this broadcast.
Okay.
Again, the states of being, the states of observation. And I've had, I don't normally share this with strangers, but I've had the experience of being declared dead, clinically dead, twice.
Really?
On one of those occasions in particular, I had what I would call the near-death experience, none of which I had any prior interest in knowing about or experiencing. Mm-hmm.
You mean like the white light, the tunnel, and beings greeting you and that sort of thing?
Dr. Future, indeed. The white light, the shimmering tunnel, the glistening light, and a sense of synchronicity and harmony I cannot, with this brain and vocal cords, describe.
Wow.
And again, I've then since had an open mind, and Mooney's analysis and many others, where this is a frequent and often described experience, as you may well know, and hopefully have yourself.
Well, and really, I'm so glad that you are bringing it up, because especially in this election season, I've noticed that there's such a focus on the headbutting aspects of the world that we're all living in, at least in the media. And when you bring up a subject like consciousness, and especially the kind of near-death experience and that incredible sense of connectedness and joy and harmony and ecstasy, it sort of counterbalances all of that weight in the other direction.
A very good point. In fact, I made the decision, as far as my own experience was, and again, I sought to have it validated hundreds of times since 1998 when this happened in a surgery, most pronouncedly. It was so nice there, Mrs. Future, and I encountered my dearest friend from high school, who had been my debate partner. Eric Thompson was his earthbound, earthplane name.
Wow.
And total gentleman. He was killed flying Navy jets 6 summers after we graduated from high school.
Uh-huh.
That's the last I saw him was August after high school, but umpteen decade and more afterwards, have this experience, and there he is to greet me at the tunnel.
Wow.
And he's in his Navy ensign, Lieutenant Junior Grade whites, which I would have never seen him in. We hadn't chatted since high school. But he went in the Navy, I went in the Air Force. And the circumstances are, if there's a person I encountered in this life's journey who had no vices, who had no selfishness, more importantly, it was Eric Thompson.
Wow. And he was there to greet you at the gateway there.
The validated, oft-quoted psychics, experts at this, other dimensional journey and there are all kinds of places like the Lilydale Center in New York, the Monroe Center in Virginia. I don't offer things on the radio, especially this profound, that I don't have a room full of evidence to support.
So how far did you connect with them, Colonel Terry? Did you say hi or give them a hug or anything?
I want to keep it succinct, of course.
Yeah.
In the surgery, I wasn't planning to give you all the details, but quickly.
Sure.
In the surgery, it was going to be, we'll be finished before 3 o'clock, and they put me down sometime after 12.
Mm.
Later, I found out during the surgery, the anesthesiology nurse who had come on at 6 a.m. to do morning surgeries was off when they decided they wanted to keep me down longer because they were getting more tissue, which might have been cancerous from my upper adenoids and my upper sinuses. Microsurgery. So a new nurse came on, and the second nurse misread both the formulation I had been given and the quantity from the nurse number one's handwriting.
Wow.
They redlined me, or I came close to that. And I recall, of course, I didn't know any of that, but I recall being elevated and leaving my body, my consciousness doing so.
You see, like, the operating room behind you, things like that?
Watching it behind me and being drawn to the light, the tunnel, and here's my friend, Eric Thompson, whom I hadn't known, observed for nearly 2 decades, who died, you know, umpteen years prior, and there he is. And the experts will tell you, they come back to us and want to show you themselves the way they wished you to remember them.
Right.
Frequently, people who passed on in their 70s and 80s,
mm-hmm,
are told to materialize or appear in their 20s and as they were in their 20s and 30s.
Their prime of life.
Exactly, Eric. So there he is. I would have never seen him as a Navy lieutenant. And behind him is the shimmering light, the tunnel, described by many. Hmm. And he's inviting me in mental messages, thought messages at the speed of light or thought, but just instant messages, to come with him. And there's nothing I'll miss here on the earth plane. Term I'd never recall. Okay, I'll just compress to the more important parts. At a dialogue.
Yeah.
Paragraphs of dialogue. And I said, it's nice here, okay? And he said, there's nothing I'll miss here. And again, the harmony, the continuity was clearly evident to me. I elected, as many people who've had near-death experiences will describe, to come back here. And I just communicated to Eric Thompson's personality, I'll call it, my good friend, then and now, I have projects back here on the
projects.
Commitments to do.
I'm not ready.
See the light in the tunnel. What? Okay, very nice, and it's all nice to know that it's here. And he said, well, there's nothing you can do or capable of doing, Terry, to deny you coming back here to us at the light in the tunnel, and you may elect to return. And while you're returning to the earth plane, you may decide to come back before you re-enter your body. Okay, just think about it. I then went to the operating room. I watched what was going on. It was a training hospital, and my doctor was world-renowned, so I had authorized 5 medical students to watch, you know, like from an elevated platform in this hospital operating room. And there was the clock. It said 4:30 instead of 3 o'clock. Remember, the doctor said, we'll be finished before 3, Terry, and then I'll see you tomorrow morning to see if I can send you home the following day.
So it would be in a full day.
I waited. Here we are, 90 minutes after to be done. I waited and pondered. It was so nice there, Mrs. Future.
You just took a little afterlife vacation.
Suddenly decided to, all right, I've got these commitments to do. Return to my body is my recollection. And 5 hours later, the doctor is coming to see me at 8 p.m. to see how I'm doing, being souped, offered soup by the nurse. And I said, I know you guys thought you hurt me badly. And he says, Terry, we thought we sent you to the happy hunting ground. And I then said, tell the nurse not to feel bad. I'm fine, and I'm not hurt.
Wow.
Avi Esther.
Well, so the phenomenon comes up when the mushrooms decide the phenomenon wants to come up. The physical discomfort, so like waves of nausea or actual vomiting, tummy grumblings, headaches, any of these kinds of what I would call home physical holding patterns. So people who tend to get headaches, that's the physical pattern that will come up when they're resisting the emotions that the mushroom is wanting to come up. And the thing is with this mushroom, which I say probably as much as I talk about the mormors, is that the mushroom rewards bravery. So if you resist it, the mushroom will put that pressure on you, and you will have physical discomfort.
Hmm. So the symbiosis process is really surrendering, or it's sort of relaxing, going with what wants to come
up. Yes. And if you do that and you're able, and you feel supported in facing whatever trauma or emotion or grief wants to come up. And if you are able to step forward and face it and feel it and feel the support of the mushroom with you, then as you move through it, knowing that you will come out the other side, it rewards you in the most amazing ways. And everybody has these incredible stories of how there's this extra reward that happens when they take these courageous actions to really face what's coming up.
Well, as a therapist, do you sit with the patient for the full duration of the trip?
Yes.
You charge by the hour?
No, that would be ridiculous because so it depends on purpose, right? So it's like if somebody's coming to me because what they're wanting is to look at trauma patterns that are running and they're ready to actually rewire them, which requires facing them, feeling them, and then being able and ready to receive the experience that they needed to happen but did not experience.
Mm. So you can be in a receptive state with a therapist when you're on Amanita and take feedback.
Like I said, there's different kinds of journeys with Amanita, and it depends on your biochemistry and it depends on your dose and all of these different factors. So I know how to make the preparations for the journeys that the individuals want to take.
Gotcha.
So like really low to medium doses, oftentimes they're quite short because people like the deeply intoxicating parts are done. And then like within sort of 3-4 hours, and then even though the mushroom is still active in the person, it doesn't inhibit your ability to see. It doesn't inhibit your cognitive function. Mm. As long as you're safe and you feel supported, you're free to go.
Mm. Do you ever experience any superpowers or new human awarenesses like telepathy or psychic connectivity?
Me personally like other people?
I guess, for you personally, I would then say it was probably true for other people too. But yeah, I'm just wondering
I've always had abilities, and what Amanita muscaria has done for me is help me not be afraid of my own power, not be afraid to just name what I see, and to be able to know when it's appropriate to speak and when it's not appropriate to speak. Just because I see it doesn't mean I need to talk to it or into it or share what I'm seeing. So when I'm like running a class, for example, like I run these full moon self-love classes, and during those, people in that field of energy begin to pop, their trauma just begins to release. And so I know, and I can see, and I facilitate that. Total strangers, and they're like, how do you know? It's like, I see you. How do you know? I see you. Like, how did you know that they did that to me? I was like, I see you. It's okay. I've got you. And I just have those abilities. But since working with Amanita muscaria, I feel so comfortable in my own skin. And so for anybody else who has these kinds of natural abilities, but fear or conditioning or shame, for example, shut them down when they were young or whenever, it really helps to face those blocks within self and allow out your natural evolutionary abilities.
Mm. Now, can that include creativity? Can you write on it? Or?
Definitely. You can write, you can draw, you can dance, you can sing. Oh my gosh, singing and movement, especially on low and low medium doses, it's as good as MDMA in my mind.
Wow.
Yeah.
What do you see the future would look like with Amanita? How would you envision it unfolding? What would you like to see?
Gosh. Well, I have quite a strong opinion about the whole of the entheogenic movement, in that I feel it's a crime against our birthright as human beings being born on a planet to make something that grows illegal. And I think that there's something very interesting that Amanita muscaria has not been legal in the majority of places. And while we children sort out our silliness.
Yeah.
I feel like there is a balance coming in where there's a calling forth of real elders. And I don't mean old people. That's not what I mean when I say elders. I mean people who have a spiritual maturation and are able to hold that energy of elder, of wise woman, of wise man, of listening, of laughing at the small stuff, of holding the grief and really bringing people back into the center of community. And I mean that in the most natural term as opposed to any kind of philosophical concept.
Bring out and the wise elder in all of us, ultimately.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I think that I would like to see this continued movement forward in symbiotic relationship in all the pillars of our society. And I think that within the psychedelic community and within the healing communities, that this other mushrooms and herbs are really beginning to create an environment that invites people into more respect of themselves and others and more balance. And I think Amanita muscaria more so than psilocybin, because you can eat as much psilocybin as you want and you might have a really intense psychological experience, but it's not going to kill you. Whereas if you disrespect Amanita muscaria too much or you go too wonky with it, it can kill you.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point, because that also has been why it isn't illegal, because it was considered a poison by some.
Yeah, but the doses are pretty high.
Right.
Alcohol kills more people than Amanita, I promise.
Fly agaric. Now, that name came from thinking of it as a poison, right?
Yeah, so the fly agaric is just the colloquial name for the Amanita muscaria.
Right.
You know, but you have a whole list of indigenous names, and in Germany they call it the lucky mushroom.
Shamanic uses in Russia, I think Siberian shamans, I think you're using it as well.
Yeah, they're still using it, but not just even like it's a mixture. It's not just the shamans who use it. So indigenous people of Siberia during the winter months, they just chew on it. They stick it in their mouth and then they get on with their, you know, walking the mile to get the water or carrying like all these logs on their head and like really physically hard labor, and it's cold and there's not a lot of sunlight, and they use it to fortify them, to give them the strength that they need to carry out the tasks that they have to do. And then you have these wonderful folk medicine women predominantly throughout Eastern Europe in the Slavic countries who work with this mushroom and many other traditional old school medicine women. They don't know English. I don't even think they care.
Richard Marriott.
It's funny. I came up with this title for quite a while, The Accidental Psychic.
Accidental Psychic.
Just out of curiosity, decided to look up if it was somebody else had it. And someone in Britain had it. And the book was only published over there. I still feel free to use it. People use the same title for different things all the time.
So is this really events where you accidentally were a psychic?
That's pretty much it. Not someone who could hang up a shingle and say I'm a psychic, but I've had many experiences that were inadvertent. The subtitle is Inadvertent Adventures in the Paranormal.
Can you give us an example?
Experiences happen inadvertently. I couldn't hang a shingle out and say I'm a psychic. They just come randomly. An example of that would be in the early 1980s, I was an ambulance driver in Los Angeles.
An ambulance driver?
Yeah. And I got a call to go to the ocean, and on the way there, going down the street, lights and siren. Normally, what happens is the traffic backs up when you come to an intersection, and you cut over to the left and go into the oncoming lane until you get to the traffic light, and then cut back over to the right and continue down the street. So what happened to me when I came to this intersection was I brought the ambulance to a stop. And my partner says, why we stopped? And I said, because in a few few seconds, a Chevy in primer paint without a gas cap is going to do a power skid through the intersection. We don't want to be there when that happens. And as I finished saying that, a Chevy in primer paint without a gas cap power skidded through the intersection, gas geysering out all over the place.
Whoa.
Wow.
Exactly like you envisioned there.
Yeah, exactly as I envisioned.
Huh. Now, did it come in all of a sudden, like all at once as a story, like a download?
Yeah, it did.
Huh.
Now, I wonder, do you believe in time travel? Do you think that that might be a form of time
psychic
travel?
Psychic time travel?
I couldn't say. I've asked that question myself.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, what was your experience of that?
Well, where do you think it came from? Any idea?
No.
Mystery. It's one of those mysteries.
It's a mystery.
So it just keeps happening to you, huh? Over the years?
Yeah. Different experiences of a similar intuitive nature, yeah.
I remember as we were talking about such things, you were saying something about being an ambulance driver and what a state of consciousness that's a heightened state of consciousness.
Yeah, it's an altered state. When you're driving a vehicle like that, you're in a altered state of consciousness. You're
adrenalized, I would imagine.
Yeah. And the way reality shifts for you is because the cars are moving out of the way. And it's not your everyday consciousness going on there.
Right. Do you feel in some way that you are causing it, or do you feel like somehow you're getting a message, or are you on the receiving end of something? How would you characterize how you're sensing it?
Couldn't say. It just happened.
Just happens, huh?
Yeah. There is a thing to it, is you know it as real. There's no doubt. It's not a random fantasy that I'm going to, something's going to happen like in the next couple of minutes or whatever.
You just know it's going to happen.
You just know it.
It's beyond a deja vu.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. Precognizance, I think they call it, right?
Yep.
Like Minority Report.
How about the circumstances under which it happens? In this case, it was your life on the line. I assume it's not always a life or death matter, but.
No. No, sometimes it's...
something you want to find or do. Yeah.
That's the only one where it was a life or death matter.
Hmm. Oh, interesting. Do you think that there's an aspect of this quality of psychicness that requires that there be high stakes, or is there anything that you can identify that makes it more likely to happen or less likely to happen?
Yeah, now that you mention it, it usually is... turns to some benefit in some way.
Oh. Hmm. That you realize later.
Helps me or somebody.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Well, thank you, Richard. Appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Richard Marriott, authoring Accidental Psychic. Yes. At what stage in your life or at what moment did you suspect of yourself that you might be an accidental psychic?
As a child, I would pick up the phone and say hi to the person who was calling with their name. And that was quite a normal thing for me to do.
Huh. I just knew who was calling.
Yeah, just knew who was calling. To myself, I'd say I could tell by the ringtone, but it all does the same ring. So I never had any doubt in spirituality or anything like that.
Is there any connection between your psychic awareness and your passion for photography?
Strangely enough, there is a school of thought that intuition and synchronicity go with very good photographers.